Hey everyone, your host Reed Rombo here. I recorded this episode weeks ago, but have been struggling to find the time to edit. Since the last episode, I've announced the launch of my nonprofit organization, Constructing a Difference. I just spent the last 2 days visiting the Lower Brule Native Reservation in South Dakota, and before that, I had to get ahead on work so I could take the time off. Things have slowed down now, and I'm coming to you from the van on my family farm in central South Dakota. I've got a cold IPA in hand, and I'm ready to put out a podcast. So, that being said, hope you enjoy it. This episode contains explicit language, so if you've got kids, you might want to listen to this one alone. Many of us move through our lives with our minds on adventure. A gripping wanderlust, you might say. Maybe it's some huge trip you want to go on. Maybe it's a new sport you want to fund. It could just be a plane ticket. For me, it's always been about a lifestyle. Sometimes the hardest part of being an adventurist is figuring out how to fund it. Or how to find yourself in a job that allows you to have that time off. I wanted both. I've got a special episode for you guys tonight. I'm going to sit down with a good friend of mine and talk about when we played our chips all in to facilitate the ultimate dirtbag lifestyle. But we lost everything. I'm your host, Reed Rombo. Stick around. This is Adventure Horror Story. Let me set this scene for you. In January of 2013, I decided to quit both of my jobs, sell everything that wouldn't fit in the back of my truck, move out of my cute little Salt Lake house, and move out on the road with my dog Sadie. I had a business plan in the center console of the truck, and had this huge dream to start my own climbing gym in Rapid City, South Dakota. After 4 months of traveling and climbing, I was driving from Horseshoe Canyon Ranch, Arkansas, a climbing destination, back to South Dakota. I realized on the drive that I wasn't going to have enough money to make it back. I had exhausted my travel funds. I planned to stop in Kansas City to find work on Craigslist until I could make it back to South Dakota and figure out what to do from there. A buddy of mine, 11 years my senior, and an electrical engineering professor hopped in the truck to ride back with me from Arkansas. My business plan sat on the floorboard between us. He casually picked it up and leafed through it for almost an hour before he looked at me and said, "Dude, this looks really good." "Yeah, I'm psyched on it, but I've been looking for an investor for 4 months and I can't find one." "How much do you need?" he asked. $100,000 for a down payment on the loan." "I'll give that to you," he said. I thought he was kidding. He wasn't. We hashed out a loose plan during the long drive. As we neared Kansas City, I told him he would have to hop in with the other car because I was stopping in Kansas City. "What's in Kansas City?" he asked. "Just some friends," I lied to him. He smirked. "You're broke, aren't you?" He filled my tank to get us both back, and I went straight to Rapid City to see if I could make this gym dream come alive. Fast forward another month. I've now picked a location, an old furniture warehouse. I've met with the guy who has it up for lease, and we've reached an agreement. I got approved for the loan of $320,000 with a $100,000 down payment, and I'm just waiting to go in and finalize the paperwork. I was searching for a part-time job in the process, and a buddy sends me a link on Facebook. "Rock climbers wanted for cell phone tower work," it read. Naturally, I called the number in hopes that I could find something local and part-time. After a series of phone calls, this man, Chris, offers me a management position within the company. $100,000 a year, 8 months of work a year, a company vehicle, and health insurance. The catch? It's full-time, and it's based out of Dallas, Texas. I spent the next few days writhing over the dilemma. Ultimately, I decided that with a job like that, I could work for a year and travel for a few years. With the climbing gym, I'd be married to it until it was self-sufficient, if ever. I walked away from the $100,000 investment and my dream of owning a climbing gym because only one other dream was stronger. I wanted to travel the world and climb. Chris put me up in a shitty Econo Lodge hotel in North Dallas. While staying there, in the middle of the night, a man started beating a woman in the parking lot. Her screams woke me up, and I ran out to help. I ended up in a full-blown fight with a very tall, lanky man. On the ground, fighting for my life, a cop came around the corner and saved me. I worked with an open meth addict on the towers, and a guy with four kids and four baby mamas. Oh, and I had no idea what I was doing. I literally taught myself how to do this on YouTube. The only real experience I had was from a few years of working for a tree removal service in high school, and my 6-year climbing career at the time. Chris was a young, former Marine who was using his life savings to fund this venture that he also had no experience in. His main contracts were what are called decons, or deconstructions. When Sprint got rid of Nextel, they were still paying rent on towers all over the country for that equipment, and they launched this huge campaign to have it removed. It was decons that put me on my first 15 to 20 towers. However, I was tired of working with meth addicts on towers. I wanted someone I could trust. Chris gave me free range over who I could hire, so naturally I turned a mountain project.
My name's John Paul Casciola. Most of my friends know me as JP.
JP's a Houston boy who started climbing when he was 14 years old. In high school, he would lie to his parents and say he was in class, but in reality, he was actually at Waco Tanks, almost on the entire other side of the state. In high school, he was a heavily recruited lacrosse player and ultimately went on to play for a small liberal arts college, doing so well as to even appear on the front page of the New York Times on Christmas Day once. Unfortunately, when he was 21, he broke his back and wasn't able to keep playing. He decided after that he'd focus on his career. After a summer of working for a U.S. congressman on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C., he took a job working for a planning and design firm in Colorado instead of taking a semester abroad. Upon finishing his 6-month consultancy, he decided to go to France and ended up staying at the Benedictine Monastery in the west of France, and lived and worked along the side of monks. Upon returning to school, he wrote his thesis and then took a job for the mayor of Houston as Anise Parker's special project manager. Out of the blue, he was medically cleared after a doctor's checkup to resume physical activities after 3 years of literally just doing nothing. So, he went to the rock gym and climbed, and after that he quit his job and all he did was pursue climbing, like many of us seem to do. JP fell in love with route development, and ultimately he became a regular at El Potrero Chico down in Mexico, chasing his dreams of being, well, a bum. One season, he realized he was running out of money, so he followed a friend of his up to the foothills of the Adirondack Park and became an apple farmer. But he realized that he was going to need more flexible employment if he wanted to be able to climb and travel as much as he wanted. And so he looked into tower work.
I was looking online, researching ropes access work, and didn't have very many leads other than my last climbing partner, down in Mexico, who was a level 3 IRATA tech. And I was looking at going Sprat or IRATA, didn't really have a lot of direction, was looking for classes and all that stuff, and was interested in doing like tower work specifically, because I knew that was like available all around the U.S. So like, you know, I'd done a little research online and did kind of what any climber would do. You know, I turned to the mountain project and trying to see if there were any leads for climbers that were talking about tower work even. You know, I didn't even think about, you know, finding a lead for an actual job. You know, I was still just kind of looking for like secondary information, and came across this one ad by this one dude who was actually looking for extra guys to put together a tower crew. So I responded to the post.
And that was me.
So, and that was you, Reed. Yeah, it was you. It was just this random dude from the Black Hills of South Dakota.
Yeah.
Reed Rombo. Yeah.
And so I had basically just told Chris that I was going to hire somebody extra. And he basically just gave me like free range. Like, you can hire whoever you want. And so I immediately was just like, if I'm going to hire somebody, I want to hire somebody that I don't hate almost dying with every day. And so I was just like, there's only one place that I'm going to find who I want to hang out with, and it's going to be Off Mountain Project.
And yeah, I remember getting that phone call, actually, and I remember being, like, really impressed that you were, like, on top of your game and like on your way to work, like in the middle of everything, busy. Like it seemed like there was like a lot of opportunity to be had, you know, like, you know, you needed help. I was like, oh man, like this is hot.
I totally fooled you into this false sense of security that I knew what I was doing. Yeah, like I had rented this house and Taylor was living there, and Taylor and I were both on the lease, and then you came in and moved into the extra bedroom, and it was just like a classic rock climber's house. It was like you were sleeping on an air mattress, and Taylor was sleeping on a crash pad, and I started out on a crash pad for a while before I built that bed. But yeah, so I think we left immediately for Amarillo, and that was our first like foray into Minilink, which we all went out there with zero knowledge of what we were going to do. Let me take this moment to introduce you to Taylor. Taylor and I were best friends from college, and he was looking for a job around the time that I was trying to hire. So he had already been living with me, and we had rented a house together when we had decided to hire JP. Yeah, so you, me, Taylor, Michael, and Sadie, all in my four-door Ford F-150, like loaded down with tower supplies, like going and staying in these awful hotels, eating Texas-shaped waffles every morning.
Yeah, dude. Worst breakfast imaginable, worst coffee imaginable.
I hate myself a little bit for how many Texas-shaped waffles I've eaten in my life. So anyway, we get out on these Minilink dishes, and that's when we meet Mike.
Mike was an independent contractor who came out of Magnolia, Texas, which is like just north of Houston. I guess he had gotten into the industry via his friend Randy, who's kind of like the gatekeeper of like all these contracts, or he was like the project manager for a lot of these things. So we would get sent to these sites, and Mike was kind of like this consultant that would get sent to a few of our job sites. And when we had been meeting with like other people that were just, you know, really did not know what they were doing, you know, Mike would kind of show up, and he was just like a normal dude, you know, was smart and on top of his game, and had, most importantly, he like had all the right tools, had all the right materials. You know, it was just like, this was a dude that we could probably rely on. He was a Mormon guy. He did not drink, which is very, very strange for the telecommunications industry because, you know, due to the fact that most of these guys do not have driver's licenses because of DWIs. And Mike is like sober Mormon dude.
He had the exact same first impression with us. What are these three college-educated, smart, mid-20s kids doing in the cell tower industry? He was just, his outlook on us was the exact same as our outlook was on his. And so it got to the point where he was just requesting that whenever he was sent to sites, that we were his tower crew, or that, you know, like that we were the guys on site.
Yeah, totally. And it worked out really, really well. You know, like he was, you know, we were all just so weird for the industry that we were like, oh man, this is like definitely going to work. You know, we're made for each other. We can't work with anybody else.
Right. So to paint a picture of like what's going on is that we're all very inexperienced. JP hasn't been on a tower yet. Taylor's only been on a few. I've only been on a few more. And now we're installing these really expensive Minilink dishes, like these satellite dishes that are anywhere from maybe 3 feet in diameter to 6 feet in diameter. And so you get these things 150, 200 feet in the air, they turn into like giant sails. And so we're basically just having to like learn how to get these up, get them mounted to the tower. And then the worst part is getting them sighted in, because they have to point at each other at a very specific location. And so basically you're given this sheet of paper that says this dish must go at 167 feet and it must be pointing at like 138.77 degrees in order for it to be sighted in with the other tower that's 12 miles away that you can't see, that is also has a new Minilink dish pointing on this. And so that's called a hop. So the distance between one Minilink and the other Minilink is a hop. And so basically the one Minilink shoots the information to the other one. and that one is processed and then shot to another system. And that's basically how your minutes that you've spoke on the phone, your like who you were calling, all that kind of stuff, that's how all of that data is transferred from site to site until it finds its way into, say, like AT&T's house, warehouse,
right,
or whatever. And so we are basically just learning all this essentially from Mike. Like Mike is just teaching us how all of this works. And we're on towers for 12 to 14 hours a day, you know, up at the ass crack of dawn, staying up till one, two, three in the morning, still on the tower, still trying to get the damn thing sighted in because they want it on air the next day.
Yeah, totally. Like, we were not allowed to leave the job site until, you know, we had these things sighted in correctly. You know, they were supposed to be laid out to a very specific azimuth, and hitting those azimuths was just like the hardest thing, you know. And we thought doing the install was hard. And then once we had everything like all set and perfect, everything looked pretty, you know, we thought that we were almost done. And then it would just take like 8 more hours to get these things right, you know.
And do you remember like Chris didn't have all the right tools? So, like, we didn't have a winch or a cat head, as they call it in the industry. We didn't have any of that. We're using my climbing gear. So we're using, like, my pulleys, my climbing equipment, my carabiners. All he really gave us was, like, a bunch of ropes, a few steel carabiners, and body harnesses.
And yep, that sounds about right, yeah.
Do you remember how many ridiculous ways that we had to rig off my truck to haul these dishes up to the top of these towers?
I do. And I remember being like, dude, there's no way this is kosher. Like, we should not be doing this on this site. Like, I cannot believe that we're allowed to do this.
Well, we weren't.
But, you know, looking back on it, though, like, one of the things that made us such a good tower crew was, like, the fact that we were rock climbers and we had an incredible ability to improvise in any situation. So it's just kind of like, all right, get this up there. We're like, okay, we'll figure that out. And yeah, the best way was to just like rig up a pulley system and use your truck to haul these things up.
I can't even imagine. I bet we put at least 16 to 20 of those things on towers using my truck.
Oh, easily, most definitely.
So anyway, here we are kind of cutting our teeth in the industry. We've met Mike. He's like this great guy. And during this whole time that we've met Mike, we're going out to dinner with Mike. Mike's staying in the same hotel as us. We were just like, Tower World went from like being this awful thing that I had been doing alone. So now I've got you, I've got Taylor, and we've met Mike, and Mike's like a great fit. And so like the four of us are just like these goofballs, educated, sophisticated, like well-spoken, well-carried, non-criminal goofballs.
Yeah.
Like kind of hit it off. And like things were good. Things were going well as far as like social interactions went. But all of these sites are like failing. We're getting sent back to them. I mean, let me break down the cell tower industry and how colossally fucked it is. So this is the reason why your cell phone bills are so awful. It's because AT&T decides that for Amarillo, Texas, they now want to do a mini link data transfer system to be able to transfer data quicker and more efficiently. So they draw up the project and they decide, okay, we're now doing mini link in Amarillo. These are the towers that we want sites that we want dishes on. These are the heights, blah, blah, blah. And all that gets passed down to, let's say, Sony Ericsson. So Ericsson is kind of like Sony's back end. They like make all these equipment and it goes out underneath the Ericsson name. And so Ericsson takes that contract now. So Sprint gives the contract to Ericsson. Ericsson makes all of the equipment for the project. And so now they've made dishes, they've gotten all the cables together, all the materials, everything that you need, and they send it on to, let's say, Goodman Network. We did some work for them, and I don't even think they're in business anymore. So
sure.
Because I don't even remember what the name of the contract company was that we were doing work for around.
Right, but like large general contracting company.
Right, so this massive general contract company, they have their own install crews and everything as well. But then, so then now they've got it, and what they do is they make sure that they've got all the secondary materials or tertiary materials. You know, your like the ground wire and like the nuts for the ground wires and like the banding to hold the cables against a monopole tower or just all of that stupid stuff. And then they also will find then an install crew to go and install these towers or go install right. these sites. So you've now got money passed down through four separate companies where each person's just kind of taking their little cream off the top. And then at the very end is us getting all of the shitstorm. Like, literally, the whole pile of shit comes right down on top of us because we're the install crew. So we're the final people to get their money. And so if any of the people above us are struggling to get their money, then they're going to make they're going to do everything they can to make sure that we can't get ours. So it's all these contractors, like, battling for who's going to pay who and when and who has the money, who doesn't have the money to pay and when. And so what they do is there's this period of time called net 90. So after you finish a site, they have 90 days to pay you on that site. But they have 90 days to audit you as well. And so what they'll do is on like day 89, they'll send their auditor out to the cell tower and he'll go up there and say, you didn't put Hink Shriek on this tower or on this one lug, or you didn't write the height of the dish on the back of it. And so then they restart the net 90 and they buys themselves another 90 days to not pay that contractor.
Right.
And so it's that like massive hemorrhaging of money is the reason why the whole industry is so inefficient that like our cell phone bills are so ridiculously high.
Yeah. And on top of that too, like the other benefit for at least like the cell phone providers is this like pass down of contracting helps them all avoid regulations too, you know, like this is all stuff that's supposed to be OSHA regulated, you know, and there's specific laws about how long you can work, you know, hazard pay, being in dangerous situations. And when all that stuff gets passed down basically to lands on like independent contractors, you know, it's totally unregulated and they can keep us up there for 12 hours or 24 hours, you know?
Right. And like, yeah, I never once in the 2 years that I was working on towers did I see an OSHA personnel.
Never once.
And I saw so many like OSHA violations during that time too. We're back to Amarillo. After about 3 weeks in Amarillo, working on towers like nonstop every day, we don't really ever take a full day off. Like you're always kind of doing something. We finally, like basically Chris is just like, come on back. You guys can take the weekend off. Come back to Dallas. And so after 3 weeks of being away from our house, we're driving back. And I think we were in two separate cars. I think at this point,
Yeah, Taylor had his van.
Right, that's right. So maybe we didn't all ride out together. Taylor had his van. So at this point, like Taylor has his van. We're driving back separately. So you were with Taylor, and I had Michael.
Yes. You had stopped off to drop off Michael at his house, and Taylor and I arrived at the house first. And when we get there, we like open the door, and all of a sudden, just kind of like see that everything is just off. And we're just like, oh my God, like, oh no. And we each go into our bedrooms and Taylor starts flipping out. Everything had just been rummaged and gone through and like we got robbed.
I'm on my way. I'm not too far off, and I get a call from Taylor, and he's like, "Hey, are you on your way over here?" And I was like, "Yeah." And he's like, "Okay, bye." And he hangs up. And I instantly was just like, "Shit, something happened at the house." And I remember I punched it, and I floor it, and I come ripping up in front of the house, and I come inside, and I was just like, oh my god, we've been robbed. And of course, I think it was right before we went to Amarillo, I had gone up to South Dakota and gone into my dad's old barn and like gotten my, I'm a big hunter, so I got my guns, my bow, and all that kind of stuff. And I had just finished building that bed before we left to go to Amarillo, and I had all my shit under the bed and gun cases, and I had like made my bed and then slid my MacBook underneath the sheets and was just like, I'll just leave it there, blah, blah, blah. And so I just immediately ran in and pulled my gun cases out because they were like super sentimental to me. Like one of them my dad had bought for my grandpa and my grandpa had then given to me. So like my dad bought it before I was born, you know?
Yeah. There was a lot of sentimental value to that stuff. I remember.
Yeah. And I like pull it out and they're gone. And so we just immediately or like call the cops and tell them, you know, our house has been robbed. We need you to come immediately. And like 8 hours later they showed up.
Oh yeah, the Crime Stoppers, man. They were booking it our way.
Yeah, they were on it. And they come in and, you know, he's like fingerprinting everything. We're trying to explain to them and he's like taking a full inventory of what we lost. I lost 2 shotguns, 2 rifles, a bow, a MacBook Pro with literally every memory, like all these videos and photos of like hanging out with my brother and like living in Salt Lake with him and all that kind of stuff. Like all gone, and they didn't go into our garage and steal any of our climbing gear, which we were all psyched about. But they got Taylor's flat screen.
That was huge.
Yeah, they got Taylor's flat screen TV. They got his VCR. They got your computer. I think Taylor.
Yeah, I had a flat screen monitor too. They took.
Yeah, they run fingerprints, and basically, I think before they left the house, they were kind of just like, "Yeah, you're never gonna see your shit again."
Yeah. Exactly.
And at that point, we were all like pretty done. Like we were fed up with what we had been doing. We were just like frustrated, just lost all of our stuff. And it was like, you know, 2 days later, Chris is like, you know, I'm sending you guys down. I'm taking you off the Mini Link project for a while. Sending you guys down to the Houston area and you're going to do like, it was like 7 DCOMs. You know, we've lost everything in the house already as it is. We'd only spent like maybe 2 nights in there total during this whole time.
Right.
And then we spent like 4 more right after the robbery and then like took off and went down to Houston. And so we're on our way down to Houston and Chris called me and he was questioning all of our hours. I remember I was livid. He was questioning whether or not we were actually documenting our hours. And then he started saying like, maybe we should cut JP's hours and have him work less. We should cut JP's wage. Like we shouldn't be paying JP this. We should pay him this because he just started. We should probably cut Taylor's wage. And I just like ripped into him. And I'm like, no, like you as the owner of the company decided that you were going to pay your employees this price. If that's what you want to do, if you really feel like you want to demote them, then you can fire them, pay their unemployment, and hire somebody else. It's like, I'm not going to be caught up in this, like, unethical, like, merry-go-round that you're trying to, like, facilitate here. And then at the same time, he still hadn't fired Aaron, the guy that you replaced. Aaron would just call in and ask if there was work, and he would say, sorry, I don't have anything, because he didn't want to fire him and have to pay unemployment.
Yep, that's so right. He sort of gave him the cold shoulder and sort of forced Aaron to, like, quit.
Right, and, you know, Aaron had, like, 4 kids and a wife and a house and like, a car, and it was just, like, I kept telling him, like, this isn't right. You just need to fire him and, like, bite the bullet. If you really don't want him to work for you, you need to fire him. And, yeah, he was just, like, I remember going down to Houston, I was absolutely livid with Chris and was to the point where, like, my house just got robbed. I lost all my shit. And now I'm working for this unethical asshole and I don't want to be a part of this anymore. And so I was pretty upset going into Houston. And then it was averaging like 110 degrees down there. And I remember it was our first site that we were on down there that Taylor and I had been on the tower that day and we got all the antennas off and all of the steel off the top of the tower. And then we came down and sent you up so that we could clean up and you were going to cut and lower the coax cables.
To this day, this is the single biggest and only climbing mistake, like sort of like total lapse of judgment, where I made like a huge user error. To this day, this is the only incident that was like that, and it was a very, very bad one, and it almost killed everybody. So you guys, like you said, you guys had already gone up and lowered a lot of the hardware, everything else, and you guys sent me up alone to basically go take care of all the coax cable that were wired to these antennas. And the coax cable, they're not like cable TV coax cables. These are like 3-inch wide copper coax cables, like huge. And there was probably, I don't know, was it 18 to 24 cables maybe?
Nine per site.
Nine per site?
Yeah, it was one.
Okay, but there was a lot more because there was other coax cables that would feed other antennas. But yeah, the ones we were deconning, there's about nine. Yeah, that sounds about right.
Because there's three antennas on each side of the triangle, and they each had their own antenna or their own line.
Right. Okay. Right. So the coax cables, we had to get them all off the tower. They were all snapped in, like the regulated, like every 3 feet or whatever. We had already unsnapped them all, and all I had to do was go up and cut the coax cables and lower them down to you guys nice and slow so you guys could cut them into sections that would fit into whatever vehicle they were using to haul this stuff off site. And we didn't have, like you said before, we didn't have any of the proper equipment. Like, we were just using like your climbing gear. So we were improvising, and the strategy that we were doing that, had been working for us was to basically just tie prussics onto each coax cable and rig all these coax cables to like a pulley. And the pulley would be connected to a Pepsel IDL, which is basically like a real fancy gree-gree designed for ropes access work. And we would use the Pepsel IDL to slowly lower everything off. And the Pepsel IDL would be anchored to the tower, at the top of the tower. So I'm like, my first time up there, first time alone, first time doing all this stuff. And we're just making this stuff up as we go along and pretty confident that it's going to work. And I get everything rigged up correctly, tied everything correct, had everything nice, was like double checking things. I had all the coax cable connected to the rope that was going through the pulley, and was just like, all right, cool. Like, next step is to start cutting these coax cables, and then it's going to weight the rope. And after it weights the rope, I can lower these back down. So I start cutting each coax cable. We're using a Sawzall because that's what was required to cut these. That's the only thing we could use to cut these cables. So I cut one, cut two, cut three, cut four, so on. Get to like 7 and 8, and all of a sudden, like, all the weight is, on the very last one. There's one last coax cable. Once I cut that, then the rope and the Pepsel IDL are going to catch all these things. So I radio down, let them know that I'm about to cut the coax cable, and that after I do that, I'm going to start lowering it down. So the ground crew needs to get ready to start cutting all this coax cable as it comes. And I go to cut the very last coax cable, put the Sawzall to it, cut it, and all of a sudden, everything starts falling around me. The rope starts zipping, coax cables are falling, did not realize what was going on. And these coax cables, how much do you think they weigh, Reed?
Each one's...
Thousands of pounds.
Yeah, each one's 250 feet, and each one by itself probably weighs 300 pounds, and there's 9 of them.
Correct. And these big black coax cables just start like crashing down through the tower, and I'm up on top, the rope's flying around me. It literally looks like, from the movie The Matrix, those like sentinels that go and attack the ship. It literally looked like a sentinel was falling through the tower down to the ground towards the crew at the bottom. I'm like freaking out, oh my God, thinking that I'm about to kill everybody. So that was like my first experience doing deconstruction with all you guys.
Yeah. So I remember you coming on the radio and being like, hey, about to cut the last one. You guys can go ahead and grab the Sawzall. And so we had like we were like walking back into the job site, and like all these cell tower sites, you know, it's like a couple of small little concrete buildings, the tower, and it's all fenced into like this little barbed wire fence area. So we're like walking inside the into the fence, and with the sawzall, like, you know, we're psyched, we're getting ready to like cut all the coax, we're gonna get out of there for the night. And all of a sudden, it just starts like piling up right in front of me. And I remember it was me, Taylor, and Michael down on the ground. And I was like, run, run, run. And we all just start like sprinting. And like Taylor and I run out the gate. And Michael just runs into the corner and just gets as small as he can in the corner. And these coax cables just fill up the whole job site like this really evil pile of giant black spaghetti.
And, yeah.
And it was all said and done, and like we're all fine. It didn't hit anybody. It just like somehow piled up all underneath the tower and kind of like against the building. And I just like get on the radio and I'm like, "What happened?" And you're like, "Dude, I'm so sorry." And like I could hear immediately that you were just like, you knew that what you had done was like it was so bad, and that I didn't like we just didn't say anything else. It was just kind of like, "All right, well, come on now, let's get this mess cleaned up," kind of thing. Like there was just no need for it to be like an altercation, but. Scared the shit out
of
us.
Totally. I knew I fucked up bad.
Right. And I remember we just like basically had to cut up this giant pile of spaghetti. So anyway, this is all product of it being 112 degrees out, us being on towers for like 12 to 14 hours a day. And, you know, just like making like that was, I think as far as our company goes, or like us as a tower crew, that was probably the only real mistake that ever came out of our crew. That was like, you know, dangerous. And so during this time, we're doing these decoms and we're getting to keep the copper. So these coax cables have like a copper, like hollowed out copper sleeve in them. And so from each site, you probably could get about $2,000 in copper weight for recycling the copper. At this point, I had probably already done like 20 of these decoms for Chris, and he got to keep the copper off of each one. For each job site, he got 10 grand, and that was the decommission of the tower and then stripping everything out of the building. And then he would sell the buildings or have someone else come take them. Like, he never had any, like, never lost any money on the buildings or anything like that. But he would also get this extra 2 grand from the copper. So he's making $12,000 a day. Now, obviously, he's paying us, but, like, the wages he's paying us maybe come out to be, like, $1,200 a day. So he's making, right. You know, $11,800 a day off of these job sites. And, you know, he'd send us out on a string of like 7 of these things, and we'd bang out all of them in, you know, 9 days. And he would, you know, he makes this huge, pretty penny. Well, it was around that time that we were in Houston that all of a sudden Sprint realizes, oh shit, we're losing a lot of money by letting all these contractors keep the copper. So from now on, the new standard is that you have to lower the coax down and cut it into 4-foot sections and then bundle it in pieces of 10 and leave it on the job site. And so they had these guys working for Sprint that were just going around behind all these deconstruction contracts and picking up the copper. And Chris was livid. So Chris calls me when this drops and he's like, "Hey, Sprint's decided that we no longer get to keep the copper. So what I'm going to have you guys do is when you cut up the coax and you put it into bundles, I just want you guys to keep like 10 bundles. And I'm like, "Chris, that's almost half of the coax." And he's like, "Yeah, but none of those guys that are picking coax up have any idea like what a full tower side of coax looks like. So you just keep like 10 bundles and then I'm still making like a grand extra off each site and everyone's happy." And I'm like, "No, because my name is on all of these contracts as the field operations manager. We're the ones that are all out here. And so if it comes out that like someone's been stealing 10 bundles, $1,000 worth of copper off of every site, they're going to know who to look for. And it's going to be my reputation that's on the line, not yours." I was like, "So no, I will not steal copper for you. Like, I don't even like you. So why would I help you?" You know?
Right.
And so we moved on. And I remember we had that one job site that was behind that gas station that was just like in a field. And Taylor and I were on top, or it could have been you and I can't remember who was up there with me, but we basically were just like, "I'm so tired of lowering all this steel. Why don't we just cut it and throw it?"
That would be me. I was with you.
Okay. And I think that was the first time that
we would throw stuff off, like these steel bars, and they would just get like stuck in the ground and like stick out of the dirt and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, they would get stuck like 2 feet into the ground. It was the dumbest thing, but I think at that point we had just gotten so tired of how many decons that we were doing that we're just like, well, there's no one around, we'll just throw them off. And so
Yeah, totally, totally.
it was that site. We were like 2 sites ahead of that. But it was that site that I left something on. Like, I left a tool. And so like 2 sites later, like 2 or 3 days later, I realized, oh man, I think it's on that site. So I, while you guys were working on a site, I drove back. And I drive up to the site and Jason's there. And I'm like, what? I'm like, what are you doing here? And he's just, I look over and he's got 4 bundles of coax already in the back of the truck. And I realized Chris had deemed it profitable, like profit worthy, to go and hire somebody to just drive behind us and pick out the $1,000 of copper from each site. But the problem is that no one else knows that's happening. Everyone still just assumes that we are the crew working on these sites. So it's still going to come back full swing. So Chris's ass is covered because if for some reason they bring it up, like, hey, we're missing 10 bundles, he's going to be like, oh, I can't believe my employees did that. I'm so sorry. And he's going to continue to move forward and be just fine. And we're all going to like lose our jobs and have this like giant red mark and like potentially get, have criminal records because they're gonna obviously they're gonna press
Yeah.
charges.
Yeah,
And
or like blackballed by the industry or something.
right, and so I ripped into Jason and I called Chris on the site, like right in front of Jason, and was just like, this is horseshit, this is unbelievable, I can't believe that you put me in this situation. And I just told him, like, I'm gonna finish the site and then I'm done. And I was like, I'm coming back to Dallas. So we finished that last site that we were on and we drove back up there. And I remember I went into Chris's office and I sat down and I was just like, I'm done. I don't want to do this anymore. I don't want to steal stuff for you. This isn't for me. I'm going to leave. But there's like, I had this little trick up my sleeve. And that was the fact that when I started to hate Chris, I started to reach out to Mike. And so the whole time that we had been in Amarillo with Mike on the Minilink projects, Mike kept saying that we should start our own company together. He's like, you guys are awesome. You guys know what you're doing on the tower. I know what I'm doing in the shelter. We could start this company. We're like, you're the tower guys, I'm the ground guy. And we'd have this like great contractorship. We'd make so much money. And like at the time, Mike was an independent contractor making like 150 grand a year and making his own schedule.
Yeah, maybe even more than that
Probably
too,
more than that.
actually. He was killing it.
Yeah, and us three, I was 22, 23, Taylor was 22, 23. You're
Yeah,
like, what, a year or two older than
I
me?
was a year older than you guys, maybe.
Yeah, so we were all pretty like young, and the idea of like moving over and starting this company, where we can make 150 grand a year was stellar. We were like, oh my God, like we could work and make our own schedules, we could climb, like this was our dream. This is what we had got into the industry in the first place, was the idea that like we could work 8 months out of the year, make a shitload of money, and then go travel and climb. And we're just like, that was our whole focus of doing tower work, was making enough money that when we had time off, we could just go wherever we wanted and climb wherever we wanted. And so I remember it was just kind of like, okay, I don't work for Chris, so let's try to start this company with Mike. And I remember
Yeah.
on our drive back from Houston, I called Mike and I was like, if you can meet me in Dallas this week, me, Taylor, and JP will meet with you and let's talk about this. And that was when we ended up at this like little pizza joint in Deep Ellum down in Dallas, having dinner with Mike. And I remember all three of us had beers and Mike had his like patented Mountain Dew. It was like Mike
Yeah.
and his Mountain Dews, man.
Yeah, it was
And
about those
we
things.
just basically hashed out that, we would start our own LLC and that we would each be our own contractor but operate underneath like his business name. And so we'd all be
Yeah,
our own.
his insurance too.
Yep, and his insurance and everything like that. And then we would see how things would go, and if we enjoyed it, then we could have our own entity, our own umbrella company, etc. And that was
Yeah,
it.
yeah.
Like,
Yeah, so Mike and it was gonna work out for everybody because Mike still liked doing, some projects on his own because that was like super profitable for him. He understood that we were living a very specific lifestyle and you know, he knew that it was very, very conducive to us that we only wanted to work, you know, 5 to 8 months a year. You know, that was our goal, is we wanted to work, or at least me, you said 8 months, man. I was looking at just trying to work about like 6 months a year, you know, like that was my goal, is to work half a year, make $100,000 a year, and like I'd be set. I could do whatever I wanted.
Right.
It really was a no-brainer, because what we were essentially doing was cutting out the middleman that was our employer. You know, our employer, our boss, did absolutely nothing. He ran this whole business like from his house. And, you know, it was basically just like taking all the money from our hard work. So we're like, oh my God, like we know what we're doing. We can do this better than him. And we'll just cut him out. And all of a sudden we're making like tons more money.
A few things that have gone unmentioned are that Chris never gave me this health insurance that he promised me. Never gave me a company vehicle. Nor was he paying me what he had initially discussed on the phone. I had been duped by this corrupt man and uprooted my life and moved all the way across the country for him. I needed to get out. And even though the risk of starting my own business at 23 was huge, I still had so many dreams of this ultimate dirtbag lifestyle. What better way to facilitate international climbing than to be your own boss, right? A lot was happening for us around that time. Taylor was super apprehensive about going into business for himself. Rightfully so. None of us wanted to live in this house anymore, so I started putting our furniture up for sale on Craigslist. And there was weeks of downtime before Mike was able to find work for all of us, and during that, JP and I were nervous. Had we made a good decision? Ultimately, Taylor stepped away, decided to pursue something different. But JP and I hung in there. We finally get like the call from Mike, like, I have work. It's just north of Nashville in a small town called Clarksville. And we're like, oh, sweet. Like, what are we doing? He says, we're installing LTE for AT&T. And both you and I are just like, what? We know nothing about that. We've never done antenna and line work. We don't have any idea how it works. And he's like, well, we're going to learn. And Mike pitched us as this triage crew. He basically pitched to this company that we knew what we were doing, that we were faster than everybody else, and that we could come in to this project, this LTE project that was failing. It was like months behind schedule. And basically we were going to speed it up and get it done, and so that they would stop losing money. And that was how he pitched us. He essentially just kind of bullshitted our way into this project. And I remember he he negotiated himself for $50 an hour and both you and I for $35.
Yep. And I remember that.
I was ecstatic. I was like, $35 an hour? I mean, you have to remember, like, we're 23, 24 years old, dirtbag climbers, living out of my truck. When we had that house, I slept in it for 10 nights. I slept in the house for 10 nights. But other than that, I had been like living in the truck. I had been living in shitty hotels. You know, there were nights where we were sleeping in the truck. Every time that I would leave.
And we had nights where you were sleeping on job sites too.
Yeah.
The computer, those little like concrete bunkers that they kept all the computers in were like highly air conditioned to like 60 degrees.
Yeah.
Because there were so many computers inside. So we would like sleep on site inside those buildings.
Right.
Because it was like 100 degrees outside. But like 60 degrees in these buildings.
Yeah. So we were psyched. We're like, 35 an hour? Hell yeah. So we both, like, I drove from South Dakota. You drove in from Houston. And we're in Clarksville, Tennessee. And we essentially, on the way, I remember Mike emailing me all the schematics for how the wiring diagrams and everything like that for the radio frequency cabling and all the monitors and all the systems that go into an LTE network. And I remember him emailing me all the schematics for that and just driving with it on my steering wheel, trying to memorize it.
Yeah.
And we
the
show
RFDS,
up.
The RFDS. That's what they were called. The RFDS.
The RFDS. Yeah. And yeah, so we like show up and we showed up at our first site and just no one else was there. It was just you, me, and Mike. And we just went to town, like learning how it all went together. And so basically we were swapping over this whole network in Clarksville, Tennessee from AT&T 3G to LTE. And so what we would do is we would build the whole site around the old 3G system. And then once we felt that we were confident that everything was ready, they would power down the site at 10 p.m. And when they would power down the site at 10 p.m., which is considered the maintenance hours, they would then we would unplug everything that was LTE or that was old 3G. And then we'd already have all the cables for the LTE like zip tied close to their respective ports. And we'd plug all the LTE ports in and like install whatever cabinet that we had to install for LTE and plug all that into the power source. And then we'd say, okay, it's ready. And then there was just this guy on a computer who would then do all this work to integrate that system, like the new LTE system, into AT&T's new network. And so we were essentially completely restructuring the network for this whole region. And we were studying the schematics on our steering wheels as we drove into the city.
Absolutely, absolutely. We had zero experience with any of this stuff, and we actually picked it up pretty quickly. You got to give us actually a lot more credit for that, because like this project was totally screwed up. And you know, we were brought in as what was called Tiger Team, somebody that basically comes in behind people that make big mistakes and go in to fix those mistakes and then complete the job correctly. So like that was like the nature of this whole project, you know, and that was the nature of like the 2 months we were there. It was like unbelievable how much money that these contractors were wasting by sending crews onto the site to basically try and do something, mess it up, and then they would send us in after to fix everything. And like it was super frustrating because we probably could have done everything way faster if they had just let us done it from scratch to begin with, you know, instead of constantly arriving at every site being totally done incorrectly.
And that, like, still to this day, those 3 months that we spent between Clarksville and Nashville are the hardest months I've ever worked in my life.
Totally agree. Totally agree. You know, like you were saying earlier, we were making like 35 an hour, and you didn't put that into perspective that we were working like 100, 110 hour weeks.
Easy.
You
I
know,
remember
we
more
were
than once we worked like, you know, above 30 hours for a day.
totally, totally. We would like, I mean, our schedules were just totally off, man. We were just raking it in and just always on a job site. And this is probably illegal how much we were working,
Oh,
you
for
know?
sure. And it was just like, I mean, I remember some nights we'd sleep for 1 or 2 hours in a hotel and then go right back out to work. And some nights we would just, there was a little climbing area, a little crag close to Clarksville. And
King's Bluff.
King's Bluff.
King's Bluff, baby.
Yeah. And I remember we would
I
just go
believe.
park in the parking lot there and pass out. And we would just be so out of it that the sun would come up. 'Cause, you know, we'd work till 4 or 5 in the morning and then just go park in this little like crag parking lot and we'd pass out. And then we'd like wake up to having all the four of the doors open. Sadie's snuggling one of us. You're sleeping on the front bench. I'm sleeping on the back bench of the truck with our feet hanging out the doors. And there's all these people there like go hiking and they're just staring into the truck like, what is going on in there?
Yeah, the crag was actually like somewhat conveniently located to where we were, you know. It was like actually like geographically made sense for us to go sleep there rather than like our hotel.
Anyway, those 3 months, like those were the first 3 months that we kind of were operating underneath our own contractorship. I had bought an LLC before I went out there and named it Nomad Tower and Wireless. And it was 2 months and it was like $17,000 or $18,000, right?
Yeah, something's really not what it should have been.
Yeah. It was just like stupid. We made a lot of money.
Yeah.
Quick interruption. I looked this up. It was actually 46 days total with a few days off. We averaged 102 hours a week, and I made $19,570 after paying for all of our expenses. And so Mike was basically just like, okay, well, it was the end of November. He said, at the end of November, most like for the this quarter, like most contract companies like shut down to plan for the next tower season because no one's working on towers in the winter. So just go have fun. And we're like, yes, like this is what we wanted. And we like both just like take off. I think he went to Mexico
Yeah, I hightailed it to Mexico immediately.
Yeah, you like hightailed it to Potrero with all of this money. So you're down in El Potrero Chico. You're down there bolting, and I went rather ignorantly, and you know, whatever. Hindsight's 2020. I went and lived with a girlfriend at the time up in DC.
That's right. Yeah. You did do that.
But literally,
oh, man, you should have gone to Mexico. Too,
and like literally every day I would just wake up and go climbing, like drive north out of the city and go climbing all day and like bouldering all the time. Met a few guys. We did some sport climbing. I went up through Pennsylvania and climbed all over up there during that time. And I also kind of realized that like, I didn't want to be with this girl anymore. So I remember I caught a flight down to Red Rock to climb with Taylor for like 2 weeks. And then flew back and just, like, packed up all my stuff and moved out and went to South Dakota, where I ended up, like, skiing and hanging out in South Dakota until I, like, essentially spent all my money. And, like, just blew through all of that money in the course of, like, 4 months, just, like, jet setting and, like, climbing and just partying whenever I wanted. And got back to South Dakota and was basically just like, all right, Mike, like, let's start lining some stuff up. And so during that time, like, I was making calls, like I was calling a few of the guys that I had met doing mini link stuff with Chris, and there's just, you know, we were like lining up all this work, and so Mike had basically just been like, hey, how about this? And this, I don't think I ever told you this, because I never really wanted it to, like, I always thought that it would make you feel bad, but so Mike basically just told me like, I want help finding work, but if you're going to help me find work, then I want you to split the insurance payment. So I started splitting the insurance payment for Mike. And I think it was the stupidest thing I ever did. Because I sank so much money into that over the course of the next year and a half. And so I started looking for work, and Mike basically just told me like, here's what I'll offer you is if you help me look for work and you split the insurance payment, then once we pay out whatever wages we've got to pay, I'll just give you half of what's left over. And in my mind, I thought, oh, like that means I'm going to make more money. Like I'll just do that. But in reality, like I was just making less money. It was the stupidest idea. I don't know why I ever agreed to it, but it was just, you know, I was just young and dumb, and there's lots of reasons for why. But so I started splitting this $4,000 a month insurance payment with Mike. So I was paying $2,000 a month for insurance during that time. And so anyway, then we lined up all these projects. And so we had all these projects on the books. And I remember Mike had a bookkeeper, and he basically like sent me this email one day of all the projects that we had lined up. And they were all AT&T based projects. So it was all antenna and line work for AT&T. And he sent it over to me, and he's like, this is what we can expect for profit this year if everything goes smoothly. And it was like $260,000.
Yeah, I was about to say, it was over $250,000 that year, I remember.
It was insane. And I was like, oh my God, like I'm going to profit $200,000-something? Like, that's insane. And so I was psyched.
I'm pretty sure when I heard that, I bought a car.
And it was like on the books, man. It was like, these projects are going to happen, and this is what my profit's going to be. Like I moved forward assuming that by the end of the year, I'd have $250,000 in my pocket. But we kept getting like bumped back. Like it wasn't starting. And so we just kept waiting for months.
It was so long.
And it was kind of just to the point where it was like, okay, like our 4 month, 5 month vacation has turned into like a 6 month vacation. I'm out of money. I started working for a buddy of mine back up in my college town, just like remodeling apartments, so that I was at least just like operating at a neutral, you know, like a break even point where, you know, my food and everything, my bills and everything were just getting paid by this work, and I wasn't losing any more money. During that time that we were trying to lock in all those AT&T projects, like the stadium, there was one of them that squeezed out, and that was Center Texas.
That's right.
Yeah. So that's why it seemed like it was like literally the worst place on earth is Center, Texas.
Hell.
We all show up at Center, and we've got this 500-foot cell tower with the antennas at 497 feet.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's a guy line tower, yeah, too. A brand new type of tower, something we hadn't worked on. The most dangerous type of tower in the industry.
Yep. And And Mike's basically, Mike's like, yeah, it's an LTE project. So I'm picturing what we did in Tennessee. You know, I'm like, I'm going down there like, sweet, I know how to do LTE. No, this was a site where they wanted all of the antennas to come down, like a full decom and a full reconstruction of a whole new antenna frame for each side of the tower. So three brand new antenna frames, brand new radios, brand new antennas, brand new lines, a new line, like new lines run up the tower, everything. It was a $27,000 gig. And
yep,
we went down there thinking that it was going to take us about 2 weeks, $27,000 in 2 weeks. And that, you know, during that time, we would try to lock in other stuff. JP, I lived in Center Texas for 2 months.
I remember, man, you were there a little bit longer than I was.
Every time that shit went wrong, I had to stay there because Mike had run out of money. We all had run out of money, essentially, like as a company, to the point where I couldn't leave the hotel room because if I left, they would issue me an invoice.
Right. I do remember that. And I hadn't gotten there yet. I don't know what I was doing. I hadn't gotten there yet. I remember getting phone calls from Mike just being like, JP, like, we really need you down here. And I don't know what the holdup was on my end. Maybe I was still in Mexico or maybe I was in New York City, but you guys were hurting, and like, remember when I finally got there, it was like already in very bad shape. You guys were like, by the time I got there, the project was already overdue. Like, y'all should have been done.
Yeah.
You know, like, y'all should have been able to like complete this without me. This was just going to be like, you know, some little project that, you know, maybe I would like come in on at the end and help you guys button up or something.
Right. So yeah, for like weeks, I had been sitting up on the tower, 500 feet up, swinging around all alone, no help, trying to like, you know, like get all this stuff ready to drop. And we kept running into situations where we didn't have the right materials. And we'd be like, guys, you sent us the wrong part. We didn't send us enough parts. And we kept getting this hold where they'd be like, okay, we'll get it to you in a week. And so then Mike would be like, okay, I'm going to go home to Houston with my kids. And then I would just be sitting alone. In this shitty hotel at Center Texas, like all by myself for a week with no one around.
Yeah, you would call me and be like, dude, I'm not happy right now. Like, this is not cool. Like, JP, you need to get down here. And I was like, okay, man, like, I'm on my way.
Yeah. They finally, basically, they were like, we're sorry, we're screwing all this up. And we were working for a company called Goodman. And so they said, we're going to send you some guys so that Reed can basically just run point on this project and have these employees. So they sent me the worst crew you can imagine. Just like all these ex-cons and a bunch of fat guys. A couple of the guys were so fat they couldn't fit on the interior of the tower to climb the ladder.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, it's super skinny and thin to get up. It's a 500-foot ladder. You're climbing the shit with like all steel everything. Most of the time carrying like a 13 mil tagline too, you know?
Yeah.
Like unbelievable. And yeah, these dudes, they couldn't get in. And with all the like fixtures that were inside the tower, like you would climb up and just get gashed by these things like sticking out.
Oh, it's the worst. And so anyway, they had this one guy, he was their rigging supervisor. And I cannot for the life of me remember what his name is, but I want to say it was something like Manny. So we're just going to call him Manny for the sake of the story.
Sure.
So anyway, they have this guy Manny, and he's this like tiny little guy. And Mike pulls me off to the side at like the first day and was like, that guy is on a trip. And I was like, what do you mean? And he's like, he's on crack right now. I was like, what? And he's like, yeah, I worked with a bunch of guys who were constantly on coke or crack, and they're always like, that's exactly how they act. They're super manic. They basically like, they didn't give me any way to rig off the top of this tower to drop all these, you know, thousands of pounds of steel and radio antennas. So Manny was supposed to be bringing out the gin pole, and
the gin pole.
And so the gin pole was basically, it was supposed to be this like steel pole that like bracketed onto the side of the tower at the very top and gave you an additional like 6 feet of rigging room so that you could rig down to these, you know, giant metal frames. And so he shows up and he's got this like weird little like painted triangle. It basically just looked like a capital letter Y. And he's like, I'll go rig it up for you. So he goes to the top of the tower one day. and he gets it all rigged up, and he drops the antenna off. And so now the service is out. Like, there's no service coming off of that a specific azimuth on the tower. And so he starts down climbing right after he drops this thing. And there's another guy, like, climbing up the tower that works for them. And so Mike's, like, lowering this down to the ground off of this guy's gin pole. Like, Manny's climbing down. And I'm looking at Manny, and I realize he's climbing the outside of the tower, and he's not connected. He's, like, free soloing down to the ground. He's going, like, super fast. And when he gets over to me, and he's like, it's rigged. And at that point, I had already gotten the frame off of the rig and had rigged on to the new frame that was going up, which is, like, 3 or 4 times heavier than the old one, and I'm getting ready to haul it. And he's just like, it's rigged, I gotta go. And he jumps in his truck and he just drives off, doesn't say another word.
Oh my god. So I showed up, I think, a day or two after this.
Yep, you
did. You almost got killed right here, didn't you?
Yeah, yep. So this, I think this might be the closest I've ever come to dying.
When this happened, I immediately came to the site. This is what brought me to the site. I was like, things got out of control here. And I was like, okay, I'm there. I'll be there tomorrow.
Yeah. So he leaves and Mike, like, does a test rig and, like, gets this frame, hoisted up off the ground. So now this guy's rig is holding the weight and there's this other employee up there. And I'm just like, okay, I'm going to race up to the top of the tower so I can, you know, help this guy get this bolted on. Like, we were going to go get it live, like, that day, like, this part of the build. And most of these guys take, like, 30 to 45 minutes to climb the tower. And I remember, like, we could do it in, like, 11 or 12 minutes. But it takes, totally. it takes 20 minutes for the damn frame to get up there because the winches are so slow. And so I'm, like, booking it up the tower, and I get up there. And I remember when I get to this guy, he just looks terrified. And I'm like, hey, man, are you okay? And he's like, I don't know, man. There was, like, a lot of noise going on up there. I can't figure out what's going on. And when Manny was down climbing, he just kept whispering, that shit's going to blow, that shit's going to blow, that shit's going to blow. And I was like, what? He's like, I'm telling you, man, that's why he was climbing so fast, because he was so nervous about something. And so I finish out the last, like, 20 feet to the top of the tower where this guy's got this thing rigged. I'm going to do my best to explain how messed up this is, but if you imagine that the top of a cell tower is a perfect isosceles triangle. Or equilateral triangle, sorry. It's a perfect equilateral triangle. He's now got the two legs of the Y of this thing that he brought. He's got those, like, straddling down the two portions of this equilateral triangle. And he's got them lashed with, I shit you not, hose clamps. Like, what you use to keep water from leaking out of your garden hose. Those little, like, tiny half-inch bands of metal. He's got them latched. He's got it lashed down with two of those, with the leg of the Y, like the main portion of the Y, the trunk of the Y, sticking about 4 feet away from the tower. And it's now currently holding somewhere around 2,000 pounds of weight. So he's got a lever. He built a lever at the top of this thing. It's a perfect lever. It's the worst way to rig weight ever. And so these little itty bitty hose clamps are holding like 4,000 pounds. And I get up there and one of them has blown. It's only being held by one. And I'm just like, and I could see it just going, ing, 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 ing. I could hear it. I could hear it expanding. And I'm just like, holy shit. And I didn't even get on the radio. I'm 497 feet up. And I just look down and there's like 8 guys standing below this tower. And this, you know, 2,000 pound chunk of steel, a huge chunk of steel, is just hovering right over one of the guy lines. And so if one of those guy lines gets taken out, the whole tower comes down because all three of them have to be perfectly tensioned in order for it to stay standing. And right. I just realized, like,
yeah, you should explain that to people about the guy line towers. Like, guy line towers are basically these, like, real thin towers that don't have, like, a big foundation, and the thing that holds them up are the steel cables that you see that run, like, from the tops all the way down to the sides. And if anything happens to these cables, like, the entire integrity of the tower is totally gone.
Yeah, it falls for sure. And so there's typically about 4 of them attached in different heights going up the side of the tower. And this frame is now sitting above the 4th one. So if it falls, like, if it breaks, that thing's going to fall through all 4 of those guy lines and rip them all off.
Right. And effectively knocking over the 500-foot tower.
Yeah, like this tower, this 500-foot tower is just, yeah, it's going to collapse in this huge pasture that we're in, and it's going to kill everyone below it and everyone that's on it. And so
which happens in this industry.
Right. While we were working on towers, there was multiple guideline towers that collapsed and killed multiple people.
Exactly.
And so I just start screaming. I'm just like, get out of here! Get out of here! The tower's going down! And Mike just stops the cat head, and I just see all of them sprinting. And they're all just running full speed away. Like, Mike just tied off the steel frame, and they all just ran away. And I'm up there, and I had, but I shit you not, nylon rock climbing slings. Like, just runners. And I pull these things off, I pull them off, and I just start lashing these things, just tying it down. And I'm not even, like, doing real knots. I'm just doing, like, just tying this into a quick figure eight, tying that into a quick, like, overhand knot, and just get, like, four of them on this thing, literally right as the hose clamp snaps. And the whole system shifts into these runners, and they somehow managed to catch it, but it shifted about 6 inches. So now the whole tower, which just had, like, a 2,000-pound shift, is now just rocking violently back and forth while I'm on the top of it. And it's just like bucking us everywhere. And the guy that's below me is just yelling. And I look up and it held. And so I immediately start like putting a real tie to it. So I've got like a chunk of rope that I like full on wrap and tie and like a good anchor system, like rebuild the anchor for it. And then get on the radio and I'm like, get back on the cat head, get it to me now. And so Mike like hauls it up to me. And I remember it wasn't coming in all the way because there's too much there was like too much strain in the system now that it had shifted. So I had to swing out from the tower and clip into this frame and then hook up a haul system so that once Mike started to release the tension off that winch, I could just haul it into the tower, and I just bolted it on. I bolted it down to the side of the tower, got it all set, and I didn't even hook up a single cable. I just down climbed. And I got down to the ground and I sat down, and I remember I just started crying.
Yeah, and I don't think you went back on the tower until I got there.
I didn't know. I
got there, and I don't think you went up for like a couple of days after I was there. You were just like, dude, like I'm not going onto that tower for like a while. Like, you got to do this. I was like, all right.
Yeah, I remember like Mike came over and like put his hand on my shoulder, and I just looked up at him and I was like, Mike, I for sure almost just died. And. We realized that like Manny had known that was going to happen. He had intentionally rigged that thing where shit, because he was hoping that it would fail and that things would break and that we would get kicked off and he could take control of the site.
That's right. Or that like everybody could just leave. Like nobody wanted to be there.
Yeah. And so I reported all of that as a near miss to his company, and they fired him. And I remember when you showed up, I told you the story and you were like, if that guy shows up on the job site, I'm going to kill him.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I mean, like, dude, our lives are at stake here on this stuff. Like, people really didn't get how dangerous this stuff was, and more so, like, not how dangerous just the work is, but how dangerous the people are. You know, like, most of these people are like, they're like at the same status as like Homer Simpson.
Right. So that was like the peak of the worst for me. At this point, I was really down on the tower world. I really kind of just wanted out. But, you know, Mike was really good at convincing us that there was so much promise to it. And it was after that that we, all the AT&T's, like, everything just got shut down. And Mike reached out to this guy, Randy, again. And Randy started facilitating us doing tower modification work. We moved into like full on steel work, which we also had no knowledge of. And now all of a sudden we're in like North Alabama, South Georgia, doing all this steel work. Yeah. I think it's just like kind of just kept plummeting. Like, we kept running into the same system where it was, we'd get these materials. We wouldn't have the right materials, or we'd like finish a site.
We'd show up to a job site and there'd be like 10 screws missing. We would drive like 800 miles to find everything we needed minus like 10 screws, which would basically amount to us not being able to render a project completed. Because of that, we couldn't get paid.
So yeah.
We would not pursue the project until all the proper materials were there.
So we
probably logged like close to 20,000 miles in wasted time driving from site to site to find incomplete,
materials
on site. Yeah.
And the worst part was, is that we'd have like three or four projects that were just almost complete. And it's awful because you're sitting on $20,000 per site. And it's just like, you'd look at it and you'd say, I have four sites that are six bolts away from being done. And like, we're waiting for these six bolts to show up in the mail. And because they have to be like custom fabricated because they're all specific. You know, we'd have six bolts missing off of four sites at all at $20,000. You're just like, we're broke as hell. Like living in the truck, trying to make that was like the couple times that we slept in shelters and stuff like that too. Was during that time as well.
Yeah.
And we're sitting on $80,000 and we just can't, can't. And so then we realized that Goodman, the company that we were working for, was also struggling with their money. And so they started doing the end of the net period to us. So they would, it'd be a net 90 period, so we'd wait our 90 days to get paid, and they would send out an auditor on the last day. The auditor would go up there and say, you know, you didn't write the right distance on this, or you...
No. What they were doing to us at that time, man, I remember they were getting us on, like, photographs.
Yeah.
On photographs of, like, so we would have to do everything correctly, which we would do, and then you had to take photographs of every little nut and bolt, and we would do that, but they would be like, oh, like this one isn't clear, and we would literally have to drive like 600 miles to go take like a photograph.
We kept having to go back to these sites, and then when they would say like that our finalization was incomplete, then they would restart the net 90. So they were essentially just perpetually extending the day that they had to pay us, and until the point where, like, so during this time I was still under the assumption that like we were going to pay your wage, and we were going to pay, like, Randall was working for us at the time, and then my brother was working for us off and on during that time. And so that I was still under the assumption that, like, the way that this would work is that if I just kept giving Mike the $2,000 a month for the insurance, that once we finished all the project, then we would take, you know, Mike and I would just split the profit in half after we paid you guys everything that we owed you. And that was when I finally started, like, crunching those numbers and realizing that, like, I was taking a huge hit. But I was still giving Mike this $2,000 a month for us to pay for our insurance. And I started having to do that on credit. And you know, Mike kept saying, like, God, you know, like, as soon as, if we could just get all these sites finished, you know, we got $100,000 here, we'll be good. You know, we'll be good.
Man,
we'll be good.
I did not know that you got to the point where you were doing that on credit, actually. This is the first I'm hearing of that.
So, like, the last few times that we paid you, like, that you received money, came off of my credit card.
Oh God.
Yeah. I paid like four or five paychecks.
That explains why it was so little.
Yeah, exactly. And we paid Randall's like last three or four paychecks off of a credit card that I was running. And like Mike had credit cards that he was paying stuff off of too. And I was paying that $2,000 a month insurance bill off of a credit card. And I also wasn't getting paid during this time either. Like, we were paying for all the hotels on credit cards, you know.
Yeah, I remember that. I do remember that.
And so,
I remember having to pay for hotels too, man. It was not fun.
Yeah. And we basically just like lost all of our money. So we went from having, like, lined up a $250,000 to $300,000 profit year to being in debt. And I'm 23. I looked at Mike one day and I said, this isn't worth like completely screwing up my life anymore. And I'm like, and at the same time, like, Mike had six kids, his house was getting foreclosed on because he, like, we just had no more money. And I just told him, like, I'm just going to give you your 50% back. Because then you're making more profit and you could potentially support your family if things start to go right. And I'm going to walk away and assume that the $9,000 that you owe me to pay off my last month of work there, plus all the credit that I had, credit bill that I had acquired at that point, I'm just going to assume that once you get yourself back on your feet, that you'll give that to me. And that was in 2015. Like early 2015, and I've still not seen that
was
money.
That, it was that late? No way. It was not 2015, was it?
No, it would have been like late 2014. You're right.
Yeah. That's it's
yeah. It was like right before that winter.
We've been out of the game for a minute now.
Yeah.
You know, it was 2013, 2014. Yeah, I think 2014 maybe sounds about right.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's been 3.5 years, and I've still never seen that money. And I know that like you still are owed money, and my brother is owed money.
Yeah. I'm owed about like. Yeah, he owes me about like $12,000 or something.
Yeah. I kept in touch with Mike. I walked away from it, kind of dusted my hands of it, went back to that same guy in South Dakota and started remodeling apartments, found out that I was decent at that, and went on to start my own company doing that as well. So I now own Nomad Construction. It's doing really well. I'm living full-time in a Dodge Sprinter. I've climbed, you know, all over the world since then. I shouldn't say all over the world. I've climbed in a lot of countries since then, you know, I'm living the dream that I've always wanted to live, and I'm still, JP, I'll be honest with you, I'm still paying off credit debt from that.
Man, that's insane, dude. That's insane.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm really sorry to hear that. I did not know that you had been paying the insurance off credit at that point.
Yeah.
You know?
The last 2 months I made that insurance payment on credit, $2,000.
Oh, that sucks.
So, anyway, all of that facilitated from us just really liking rock climbing and wanting to facilitate a lifestyle that suited climbing as much as we could.
Totally. And you know what, man, like after this whole conversation, like in retrospect, like, I mean, I know you're still hurting from that in particular, like you're still feeling the financial pain from that in particular, but like, man, totally worth it. You know, like we took a shot at the dream. And right now, what I do now is I'm an apple farmer in upstate New York. It's actually kind of what I was briefly doing before tower work. You know, I would work like 3 months a year and climb 9 months out of the year. I would work on a farm. And so I'm back doing that now. I took a full-time job on the farm about a year and a half, 2 years ago. And so I'm up here at the foothills of the Adirondacks. I'm a tester, product tester for the Access Fund. And I'm still a bolter down in El Potrero Chico, Mexico. And getting ready for this next season. And I'm psyched, man.
Sweet, dude. Well, JP, I don't think I've like fully talked about this story ever since it happened, because it was like quite easily the hardest years of my life. But it's been good breaking it all back out.
Oh man, Reed, thank you so much for having me. I have definitely not thought about tower work beyond where is my money for at least 2 years.
Yeah, I'm still thinking where is my money.
Yeah.
Maybe this will find its way into Mike's ears, and he'll remember how much he actually loved us at one point.
Yeah, maybe. You never know.
So yeah, Mike, if you're out there, we're still missing a lot of money. And we hope you're doing okay.
Yeah, come on, man.
All right, JP, I'm going to let you go, man.
All right, thank you, Reed.
Yeah, dude, we'll talk to you later.
All right, goodbye.
Yep, bye. So I walked away from a $330,000 climbing gym to try and facilitate my travel dreams. My boss was a corrupt asshole who asked me to steal thousands of dollars from Sprint. My house got robbed. I lived in and out of terrible hotels in the back of my truck. I tried to start my own cell tower business, so lucrative at first that we had close to $300,000 in profit per person for our first full year. Instead, I was nearly killed multiple times, lost every penny to my name, and sunk myself into a massive debt before walking away. Through all of that, to make ends meet during the downtime, I started remodeling apartments for a good friend. When it all came crashing down, I walked into a position building custom homes, and since then have started my own construction company, which is now my primary source of income and has funded exactly the lifestyle I've always wanted. Sometimes it takes a while, but if you keep trying, you can build the life you want. Thanks for listening to this extra long episode, guys, and let's show some love to Jay Allen. Jay mixed the Adventure Horror Story theme song and is a dirtbag surfer living the dream down in Central America right now. Thanks, Jay. Catch those barrels, brah. Did that make me sound cool? Other music in our episode tonight comes courtesy of the Free Music Archive. Check out the Adventure Horror Story website for a list of those artists. Thanks for hanging in there today. Please, submit your adventures gone wrong, and stay tuned for the next episode. This is Adventure Horror Story. Thank you.